It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And for the next few weeks, I started last week and this week and next week, all I'm going to be doing is talking about delicious food. I'm not going to be bringing up any sensitive topics about what we're doing in the environment or what's happening with the animals or what's happening in with our health. No. That's for later. Right now, it's just celebration. We're in a holiday period, and there's lots of great, delicious things to talk about. I have with me in the studio Nava Atlas, who is both an author and illustrator of many well-known vegetarian and vegan cookbooks, including Vegan Express, Vegan Soups, the Vegetarian Family Cookbook, and the Vegetarian Five-Ingredient Gourmet. Her first book was Vegetariana, now considered a classic in its field. Nava is also a visual artist specializing in limited edition artist books and text-driven objects and installations. Her work has been shown nationally in museums, galleries, and alternative art spaces and is part of many museum and university collections. Learn more about Nava at vegkitchen.com and navaatlasart.com. She has two grown sons and lives in the Hudson Valley region here in New York with her husband. And today we're going to be talking a lot about Vegan Holiday Kitchen, her newest cookbook. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Okay, so we're sitting here, and I'm looking at this gorgeous cookbook. It's a combination of some of my favorite colors. It's a very autumn feeling with the rusts and golds. And well, you're an artist, and I always think that food not only should be healthy and delicious, but it should be beautiful, too.
Oh, absolutely, and I've always looked at food as an art medium. I think that if it looks good, chances are it's going to taste really good.
Absolutely, and the great thing about plant foods is we have a huge palette of colors.
And the foods that are the most colorful are usually the most nutritious, too.
Yeah, you know, nature knew what she was doing.
That's right. I mean, she wanted us to be attracted to the right kind of foods.
Right. Okay, so holiday times are really stressful. I mean, it's supposed to be a time of joy and celebration, and then everybody like freaks out because there are gifts to buy and so many things, and you're with family, and that can be a good thing or not such a good thing. There's a lot of stress, but there's a lot of parties and a lot of food. And you put together a great collection, 200 recipes in this book to touch not only the current holidays, but all year long.
Okay, well, when you talked about the colors, kind of autumnal colors, it's because the publisher wisely chose to launch this book close to Thanksgiving. So we have the squashes on the covers, and the spine reflects some of the reds and yellows in that. So from Thanksgiving, we go to the all-important Christmas and that holiday season. I have the Jewish holidays, which include Rosh Hashanah, Hanukkah, and Passover. That's another real biggie when it comes to food. From there, we have Easter. I have a whole section for the summer on grilling. Mm. That's sort of a little bit of a hole in the vegan repertoire, is just having one really good resource for all the delicious things you can do on the grill that don't include meat. Let's see.
Oh, that is important, because so many people, when you think about grilling, you think about slapping that raw piece of flesh on the barbecue, right?
That's probably how it started, but now it's evolved to, you know, you can make so many wonderful things on the grill, including pizza, and that's just, it's so delicious, grilled pizza, so wonderful. And I have a catch-all chapter, which will also be useful during this holiday season, on potlucks, brunches, and appetizers.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit. How did you get so smart about vegan food?
Oh, a lot of experience. I mean, thanks for the compliment, but I've been a vegetarian since high school. I've been a vegan I'm entering my 10th year now. Hmm. So it was just something where, as I grew up, I had a natural aversion to meat. So I was lucky. I mean, I didn't have any rhyme or reason for it. I just didn't like looking at it on my plate.
A lot of kids have aversion to meat.
Yeah, and then their parents say, yes, but you must take that one bite. It was me. It was like if there was a vegetable on my plate that wasn't overcooked, I was in heaven. So when I was about 16, I told my mother that I wanted to cook for myself. She was fine because she didn't think it would last. I said, I want to be a vegetarian. And they, you know, kind of laughed and said, let's see how long that lasts. Well, I started to go to health food stores. I just got my driver's license. And back then it was all, the health food stores were not like Whole Foods are today or Trader Joe's. They were literally these dusty stores that mainly had brown rice, lentils, and probably a lot of expired vitamins. Wasn't that appealing, but I just loved it. I really took to it, and then everybody wanted what I was having. I then, you know, involved myself with a lot of very veg-friendly boyfriends, and when I got married, my husband was just thrilled to become a vegetarian. He had wanted to, but he's not a cook, and he's the one who actually inspired me to write my first cookbook, Vegetariana, that you mentioned before. I would just concoct things, and he said, you have to write this down so you can make this again. And I did, and after a while, I decided to combine my recipes with my visual art. I'm an illustrator, graphic designer, and I put together this very quirky book at the time where there weren't a billion vegetarian cookbooks out there. So that set me on a path that I didn't expect quite in my life, but it's been a wonderful day job. I've met a lot of incredible people, such as yourself.
Yeah, the community is
great.
It
is a community, and I guess when everything migrated online, that's when I really sense what a wonderful community the vegetarian and now the vegan world are.
So you said you went vegan about 10 years ago, and you did this with your family?
Just like I was the first vegetarian in my family, and I was the youngest, my youngest son was the first vegan, and I was so proud of him. We had taken a field trip to a dairy farm that was beyond organic, because I thought, well, you know, maybe if I buy my dairy locally, we'll feel better about it. So the farmer, with great pride, showed us around, and I won't go into great details here, but we were all kind of in our own private world, and just maybe a couple days later, he came home from camp with an uneaten rice cheese sandwich. He thought it was cheese. And I said, why didn't you eat your sandwich? He said, because now I'm a vegan. And so like a typical Jewish mother, I said, well, couldn't you have become a vegan after lunch? And besides, this isn't really cheese. So he set the pace for us. I guess we were all thinking about it to certain degrees, but we thought, you know, if a 10-year-old can do this, surely we all can.
It's funny because I became a vegetarian first. I went through that progression of eliminating red meat and chicken and then fish and dairy and eggs. And if I was going to do it all again with everything I know, dairy would be first and everything. But we've learned a lot along the way. And the whole vegetarian thing, okay, I'm encouraging people to reduce any amount of animals that they're eating. It's great for their health and it's great for the planet. But I'm an all-or-nothing kind of person. Now looking back on my whole vegetarian period, it's just not here or there, especially when I think about milk and all the things it's connected to. You know, I don't want to get down. This is a happy holiday show. I don't want to talk about all of that stuff.
I know what you're saying, though. It's something that we saw when we were at that, on that farm tour. But I hear you. And there's a wonderful book now. I think it's called Whitewash, about the dairy industry.
Yeah, and it's coming out as a documentary.
Oh, excellent.
I'm very excited. That's a great book. I talked to Doctor, who wrote that? Whitewash.
Oh, I don't know the name.
Gosh, I talked to him on this show. It was great. I learned so much. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff about milk. And so if you're listening out there and you're still loving your cheese and dairy, well, we're not going to knock it today. But we're going to give you a lot of recipes in this great book to distract you.
Oh, by the way, I was going to say, when people talk to me and say, I really could be a vegan, but I would miss cheese. I said, try Daya. It's amazing. You know, if you melt it on a pizza, it's been a while since I ate cheese, but I think that if you didn't tell somebody, it would be indistinguishable.
They wouldn't know. Yeah. Maybe it's because I haven't had cheese in a long time. I'm glad Daya is out there. I'm personally not a fan of it. I like making my own nut cheeses, and I saw you have a I have some recipes for nut cheese in
the book. I have a couple of recipes for homemade type cheeses. Mm-hmm. And I would say someone shouldn't make them and think they're going to taste exactly like dairy cheese, but they have really wonderful flavor in and of themselves. And I have a couple options in there for doing them with agar, which gels them, and you can actually cut them into slices.
Right.
And they're really a lot of fun.
They are fun. We make big batches of them and make chunks and put them in the freezer, and then they're ready for whenever we want them.
Oh, I bet you can grate them when they're frozen.
They grate better when they're frozen, yeah.
Yeah, but that brings us to a point, a really important point about holidays and feasting. We do want things that are somewhat familiar. There's something about holidays that makes you want to kind of go back to the past and relive, hopefully, the happier memories. There's a lot of those sense memories that are involved with food. So what I try to do with this book is to draw from traditions, but then add something new to them. Like eggnog becomes vegnog, and instead of using eggs, you use cashew butter, and it gives you that rich, creamy mouthfeel, and it's a lot healthier.
Praise cashews. They are the most amazing thing. I've got a new romance thing going on with cashews. I don't know, but ever since people have been making cashew creams and cashew butters, it's just an amazing dairy replacement.
It is.
It's phenomenal.
Well, I was going to say, I think that also becoming vegan, actually, it expanded my repertoire rather than contracted. And people also, there's this misconception of all the things you can't have. Well, you discover so many things that you didn't bother to look into or didn't have because you want to expand your repertoire. You really want to go a little bit further afield with the flavors and textures and colors.
Something I keep telling people, this is one of my ongoing messages over and over and over, and that is get back into the kitchen, find the kitchen, and start working it, because it's so important to make our own food for so many reasons. Sure, going out to a restaurant and having prepared food is fine, but I think for the most part, if we really want to eat as healthfully as possible, we really need to be making our own food, or at least make it so that you know what's in it so that you can be a little more savvy about ordering when you're in a restaurant. And you talk in your book about holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas where people do tend to make some of their own food for these big celebrations. And I was thinking about that when I read it, because even now, more and more, especially in Manhattan, people are ordering all of that food from restaurants and caterers and Whole Foods. You know, you can buy a whole dinner already made. And
But we need to be making our own food. You know, being in and around Manhattan, that might skew kind of how you see it, because I think once you get out of New York City, there is a lot more, for the holidays at least, as this is a time to cook. So I did choose what I call the staying home and cook holidays. So, and, you know, I know people who have ordered, let's say, some of the tofurkey, and people ask me, well, how do you feel about those? Should we talk about that a little bit?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, because that's something that comes up over and over. People want to know, well, how do I feel about the kind of the fake tofu turkeys, or they're not just tofu, I guess they have other things in them, but it's an easy way to identify them. And I say, well, first of all, it's better than the real thing.
Absolutely.
The other thing is that, again, I go back to the fact that people want something familiar, something that they have really good associations with. It might have tasted good to them at one point, but they just don't want to buy into that anymore. They don't want to participate in, you know, what goes on with turkey manufacturing. But they do want that sense of familiarity. So I say, well, you know what? It's made out of tofu, sometimes gluten. It's stuffed with grains. Once a year, it really can't be bad. If that's what you want, put it on your table.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to judge. I'd rather stuff a squash. But I also understand why people want to recreate. And also, who am I to judge? I'm making kind of a matzo ball soup that very much recalls my mother's chicken soup with matzo balls. But there's something about it. And when I first got the photo of it from Susan Voisin, who was the wonderful photographer of this book, both my husband and I looked at that photo, and we both immediately thought of our moms and our mom's soup.
Yeah, it looks like the real
thing. It does. Yeah.
Well, you know, we're a culture, we're a species that's continually evolving, and so we take some things from our past and we just make things better. So with this tofurkey thing or the tofu turkeys, when I was a kid, my mom likes to say this a lot, when we would go out to restaurants, I would frequently order turkey, and sometimes I would say in a very mature voice, turkey's been good this year. Because I really liked it. And for a long time on my vegetarian to vegan path, I was into the meat analogs and the meat substitutes. Some of the Chinese restaurants have incredible meat substitutes that are scary in their taste and texture and so similar to meat. And for a long time, I liked making... I never made... a big faux turkey on the table for Thanksgiving, but I would make a plate of maybe some turkey deli slices and some seitan or something that looked like giblets and made a gravy and put mashed potatoes underneath because it was a great memory for me. But now I've moved on. I'm not into those meat analogs as much. It's a personal choice, but I don't care. You know, as long as it's plant-based... Go for it.
And, you know, it's probably not the healthiest thing in the world.
Yeah.
It's high in salt and so on. But, you know, my sons have never tasted meat, ever.
Wow.
They like, they love the meat substitutes.
Mm-hmm.
They have nothing to compare to. They must taste good if they like them so much because they both have good palates, but they like the hardiness of them.
And the chew, the texture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The meatiness.
The meatiness, exactly. They enjoy them quite a bit, and they do enjoy those kind of restaurants that have the meat substitutes. Again, they're not comparing it to anything. They're not trying to recreate something. They like them in and of themselves.
Okay, I want to back up. So your children were raised as vegetarians.
Yes. And if I knew what I knew today, I would never have given them milk. But, you know, the internet has really opened our eyes to so many things.
Right. Well, still, how was it raising kids as vegetarians? Because this was, what, 20 years ago or so?
There was a lot less information. And it was great because we're lucky. I always say we were all on the same plate. And I told them when they were little, because I think children don't get the message that this was an animal. So they get used to something. They start liking it. Then it's hard to give it up. We said, well, we just don't want to eat animals. So I also told them, if you want to try it, because I wanted this to come from their own heart, if you want to try it, if we're out somewhere, and if you're curious, that's okay. They would look at us like we'd lost our minds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're telling me this was an animal, and now you're saying that I can try it if I want to. So they were never tempted, not for a second.
It's just interesting when you give a child who knows so much naturally.
Yes.
If you gear them on a path that I think is natural versus what most children are geared to today, which is boxed sugary cereals and sodas and all kinds of junk. And when you feed children whole natural plant foods and people are looking at you like you're so extreme.
Right. And it's interesting, many of the terms we use for meat dishes are euphemisms. We don't say, okay, we're having cow for dinner or bull for dinner or a pig. There are names for things, you know, pig, bacon or hamburger. So I think that a lot of children probably don't even make the association.
No, they don't.
And they're just used to the taste. And, you know, maybe for a lot of people it does taste good. As a child, for some reason, I didn't think so. But I'm sure that a lot of people find it quite delicious.
Okay, so let's jump in and talk about some of your favorites in here.
Well, one of the dishes that has made a big splash for the holiday season, if I can find it, is the shepherd's pie.
Oh, I love that. It's such a great comfort food.
It's a great comfort
food. People love mashed potatoes, anything with mashed potatoes.
And I'm almost there, I believe. Oh, in the photograph of it, too, it's just so... There it is.
Oh, yeah, beautiful.
You know, kind of like the golden potatoes on top. And the filling is lentil and mushroom. And so that has a real heartiness to it. And a lot of people have made it. A lot of people have blogged about it. Some people have let, I have it on my website, Veg Kitchen, also, and people write about the variations they've done with it. It seems like a very flexible recipe.
Well, it's hearty, it's filling, it's got that mashed potato thing that everyone loves, and it's not difficult to make.
Not at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, this probably has one of the longer lists of ingredients.
There's more than five ingredients.
Right, but it's still, my recipes really tend towards the simple, and I'm flipping the page, and I do like this recipe a lot also. It's called black rice with corn and cranberries, and it almost has a kind of a Christmassy look to it.
There are two things I wanted to mention here. One is I don't normally add fruits with my savory foods, and every time I have them, I love them and think, why don't I put fruit in with my savory food? So you have the cranberries in here, which is great, and then you have a roasted root vegetable dish with apples in it.
Oh, yes, yes. I really like adding little bits
just
of fruit.
Just a little.
Fruit,
Love
for
it.
For that contrast. It's really nice. It's a surprise every time
right.
you bite into
and
it.
And the other thing about all the 200 recipes that are in here, this is not a complicated book. These are all beautiful looking because the colors are so lovely, but they're simple dishes to make, simple, satisfying.
They are simple. I don't have time for complicated dishes. I mean, like everybody else, I write cookbooks, but I pretty much get into the kitchen at 6 or 6:30, and I want something doable. Of course, for holidays, we are willing and able to put a little bit more effort into it. But, you know, at heart, I'm a fairly lazy cook, and I want things that are straightforward and where the ingredients look like the ingredients, and there's not been a lot of manipulation.
Okay, there's a lot of partying going on, lots of different kinds of parties, and one important party food is appetizers. And we don't see a lot of veg appetizers out there, but you have some in the book.
Yes, we don't, and I thought that's another gap to fill, just like the grilling section.
Mm-hmm.
And so I very much enjoyed coming up with ideas for appetizers, and I have two appetizer sections in the book. One is in the Christmas chapter, where I have a proposed holiday appetizer buffet. Of course, nothing is set in stone, but it's an array of very different things. I have sweet and spiced pecans, which is really almost a no-brainer to make, garlic and rosemary roasted mushrooms. This is something I really enjoyed, kale and carrot strudel. Puff pastry is not the kind of thing you want to eat every day, but if you can eat it, if you're not gluten-free, it just dresses everything up.
Oh, gosh,
yummy. And this is what we were talking about before. It's called creamy cracked pepper cheese, with cheese, C-H-E-E-Z, and then a hot artichoke and white bean spread.
Ooh.
And that one seems also to be popular among people who have food blogs. People have talked about that. And
let's praise the white bean for a minute.
Yes, let's do that.
You've got it in some soup recipes. Wild mushroom soup.
Yes.
White beans are amazing. Okay, they're inexpensive and they're nutritious. But you puree them up, and it's like an instant, smooth creaminess that you can add to anything.
It is the cashew of the bean world. It's so versatile. And again, there's something about it that's very comforting. It acts as a backdrop. It's substantial and hearty, and there's just so many ways you can flavor it and dress
it
up.
And it's not high in fat. Although fat from whole food sources is good, and we need fat.
Oh,
but
beans have almost no fat, though. Yeah.
Well, we could have a little fat debate here. But
right. I'm for a little fat, by the way.
Yeah, no, I think fat from whole sources,
yes,
like raw nuts and seeds, avocado, maybe some coconut, they're all good. I'm not big on the oils, but whole fats are really important. And we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to talk about your new book, which is coming out after this one, about greens. And my lead in here is with fat, because when we're eating dark green vegetables, which have a lot of fat soluble nutrients in them, we need a little fat in order to absorb those nutrients in the greens. So we've got to have our fat.
Well, a lot of the greens recipes that I came up with have just a smidgen of olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm also not big on adding lots of oils to foods, but there's just something very satisfying about a tiny bit of oil added to veggies, like mm-hmm. when you roast them mm-hmm. in the oven, you need a little bit of that fat to bring out those sweet flavors and to make them crispy around the edges.
Yeah. So did you want to mention anything else in this book, or can we talk a little bit about your green book that's coming up?
I just wanted to quickly mention toward the end, too, that there's a big list of easy appetizers, and I just like the idea for holidays of having an appetizer mm-hmm. and dessert buffet. Skip the dinner.
Really? Yeah. I mean, people love that. All that finger food and desserts.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and there, I guess a lot of people are getting into what's called green cocktails now. How fun is that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know a lot about that, but, you know, I can imagine it would be huge fun with these easy appetizers.
Right. Well, we just had a bunch of juices, and you had a great one, beet and pineapple. And
beet, pineapple, carrot. There may have been a little bit of apple, but, wow, that was almost, like eating ice cream.
I would order that in a bar.
Just put a little shot of vodka in it.
Okay, so... I love the picture for this, the olive bar medley with tofu feta. That's really beautiful.
Oh, thanks. And mm-hmm. and again, that's it can't get easier than that. You take the tofu, you slice it up, you squeeze as much of the water out of it, you marinate it in lemon juice and a little bit of olive oil and oregano. And I tell you, it tastes a lot like feta. And
yeah.
you combine it with an array of olives and maybe bell peppers that you find in the olive bar at your supermarket. And you've got a kind of a fancy appetizer that takes almost no time to make.
Really good. So you've got a greens book coming out. And I just wondered, what was the motivation to do a book all about greens?
Because there isn't one. And people are really into it these
yeah.
days. You know, everybody loves kale. I always say kale is the new broccoli. People
mm-hmm.
are just, and it's almost addictive because it makes you feel so good.
Well, there's so much science behind greens, and I know I really believe greens saved my life. And there's so many immune system boosting nutrients in dark leafy green vegetables. So important. I'm glad. I can't wait to see the book. We just did at my nonprofit, ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com, a new food show called It's All About Greens, and we made 4 dishes with kale, steamed kale, a kale salad, a kale smoothie, and a green juice with kale. And I want to see more kale out there, more everywhere.
Kale, collards, the Chinese greens. Mustard greens, I have to say, was the most pleasant surprise for
mm-hmm.
me because I hadn't worked with them much before.
Yeah.
And they are great. They're really great combined with something mild like spinach, which I understand is done quite a bit in Indian cuisine.
Right.
So, yeah, people get greens. They basically saute them in olive oil and garlic, and that's wonderful. But there are so many things to do with them. So I wanted to explore it more for myself. And the fact that, again, it's a kind of a gap on the market. And I thought, well, I'd like to fill it.
Right. I'm hoping to see more green varieties in supermarkets. When I go to Chinese markets, because we have Chinatown in Manhattan and a Chinatown in Queens, and you see these piles of different yes. kinds of greens. I don't even know what they are. You know, we know more about bok choy, but there's tat soy and all these other choys, and they all have subtle different flavors, and we should have them all the time.
Well, I got into those a bit as an introduction because, again, most people don't have access to them, but I did want to introduce them
mm-hmm.
a little bit. And for my market research, I actually did go down to Chinatown a couple times, and I said, well, what is this? And I, of course, I couldn't understand what the vendor was saying, so I thought, well, I'll figure it out. I'll take a picture of it and try to match it to something on the internet. But the versatility of these greens is just amazing. Raw, cooked, braised, sauteed, stir-fried. I discovered, too, that in older books about greens, they always suggest to boil collard greens for 20 minutes.
Oh, gosh.
And then save what they call the pot liquor. So I said, what is this? 1910? The best way to do collards is to cut them into really, really fine ribbons and stir-fry them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's just delicious.
Really good. Well,
so
one
quick.
Of the things that I like to talk about greens, especially around the holiday time, is people are going to be eating a lot of treats, a lot of rich foods, and all of that's fine for a celebration, not for everyday food, but you've got to have those greens because they come in and they clean everything
yes.
out. They don't only provide healthy, cell-boosting nutrition, but they help detox, too.
Well, we all need more greens in our lives, and yeah, I hope to provide an easy way to do those. The book is going to be called Wild About Greens. My editor came up with that title,
great.
And I thought it was great.
Yes, well, I'm wild about greens. Well, Nava, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and I was so excited. I saw your vegan holiday kitchen in Macy's last week.
You're the one who told me.
I did, yeah.
I was
very
exciting.
So I hope you sell so many of these books because everybody needs a vegan holiday cookbook.
Thank you. That was a real clue that vegan has gone mainstream.
Yeah. VegKitchen.com, right?
Yes.
And there's hundreds of recipes.
By me and others from the vegan community.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you've been listening to It's All About Food. We'll be back in a minute with more delicious food.
Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Our next guest is Brianna Clark Grogan. She's the author of 8 vegan cookbooks with over 22 years' experience. Among her previous titles are Nana's Italian Kitchen, Authentic Chinese Cuisine for the Contemporary Kitchen, the Almost No-Fat Cookbook, and the Fiber for Life Cookbook. She also developed the recipes for Dr. Neil Bernard's Program for Reversing Diabetes. A teacher, lecturer, and former newspaper columnist, you can see Brianna's blog at veganfeastkitchen.blogspot.com and her website at briannaclarkgrogan.com. Woo! I'm talking to Brianna Clark Grogan!
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm excited. I've been looking at your recipes for a very long time.
Well, that's good. So you have a little bit of an idea of what I do.
Oh, gosh, yes. In fact, one of my favorites is from the Nana's Italian Kitchen, the biscotti. That's such an easy and fabulous recipe.
And, it's something that I really like because it's not too sweet, but it's very festive, and you can do all kinds of variations on it. So it's a great holiday.
Right. You know, you mentioned that a few times in the World Vegan Feast Cookbook that we're going to talk about today. But you mentioned this thing about some baked goods or sweet goods being too sweet, and I totally agree with you.
Well, you have a bit of an overload at the holidays anyway.
Especially. We're frequently invited to a vegan cookie party, and, oh, God, total sugar overload.
Yes.
It's just painful. But I don't like very sweet desserts, and that's one of the great reasons why we should all be getting in our kitchens and making stuff the way
that's
we
right.
like it.
That's for sure.
One of the things I like about the end of the year holidays more than the rest of the year is I think people get into the kitchen a little more, or they find their kitchens.
And, I hope so.
Yeah. And so I'm kind of talking more about some of the cookbooks that have recently come out specifically for this holiday period. And it's funny, when I look at your name and I see all of this information that's on your website and in your books, I think of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which to me was like the premier of all kinds of information, encyclopedia information. And I think if there was ever going to be an encyclopedia of vegan food, it would be the Encyclopedia Brianna, something like that.
Oh, thank you. My husband calls me an information junkie, and I do also run a branch of a library, small library.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I can't help myself.
Right. No, that's a good thing. And you say this book is really for everyone, and it's for anyone who wants to dig into it, but it's for people that really want the detail because you go into it.
Well, I figure if you put the detail there for people that want to know, it's there. If they really don't care, they don't have to read it. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But my first editor, I worked on many, many years ago on La Leche Lee cookbook. And she told me to write the recipes and remember that most of the people, or some of the people, will know nothing. So you have to write for those people. And then the people that are more experienced will just sort of gloss over the details. But I think that was really good advice, and I always remember that.
Yeah, I agree. And You know, I read this thing once about cookbooks, which I think is unfortunate, that people that get them maybe try one or two recipes in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep saying, read it from cover to cover. Read the entire book like a book. And then use it.
Exactly. I'm just going to give an example, a recent example, and I won't mention the name of it, but there was one new cookbook that came out, and I glanced through it, and it was okay. I thought nothing really jumped out at me. But then I had to do a review of it, and when I actually dug into it, I was just floored by the writing style and the ingenuity. You know, a quick glance doesn't always do it justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing about cookbooks. Certainly, if you have a big budget behind you, you can make it really a work of art in terms of photographs and
mm-hmm.
color. And that does not guarantee that it's a good cookbook.
Oh, that's for sure. I have, hundreds of cookbooks, probably over 500, many, probably most of the ones that I use the most don't even have photographs in them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's get to the meat of this.
Well, meat is not a bad word. You can have nut meat.
That's
and green
right.
meat and all kinds of meats.
Actually, I like that. I may reuse that. Meat is not a bad word.
The field roast people.
Okay, so you go into the first bunch of recipes are the essentials, where you talk about a number of soy foods, tofu, and seitan, which is a wheat gluten product, and how you make them. As you talked about the people who are into cooking who would gloss over some of this, you know, I read it and I thought, oh, I didn't think of that. And so sometimes even people that are very experienced in cooking, when they read someone else's perspective, are still going to pick up something. So I say
definitely.
Read.
You're talking about World Vegan Feast now, my new
I'm
book.
I'm talking
right?
about World.
Yes,
you are the author of 8 cookbooks, and now we're talking about your most recent one, World Vegan Feast.
Well, I'm still learning, and I've been cooking since I was a little girl, and I just love to discover new things. And you don't, you know, you can never know everything. So you're right. You really should, you know, pay attention to some of the stuff in the introductions and the basics in cookbooks, because you often get, you know, really good ideas and things that you didn't know about and new ingredients and that sort of thing. So I think it's important, but
new ingredients, and I wanted to talk about this. You mentioned in your book that you didn't think you were much of a baker when you were young, and you realized because your mom didn't bake much, and
mm-hmm.
and then you got into it and learned quite a bit. It's funny how we tend to stick with the foods that we grow up with unless we make a real conscious effort to learn more and go outside of that comfort box.
Exactly, yeah.
And
yeah.
even as a vegan, you know, I learned a lot, but I still kind of stuck to the same vegetables and things that I grew up with, and it's been a little bit of an effort to consciously buy some other stuff until it becomes routine.
Yes, I have, some people complain that they, you know, they don't have much variety or they don't like new things, and I just say, you know, maybe try something new once a week, you know, and then you can just learn to like some new favorites, because there's so much variety out there now, much more than there was when I was growing
yeah.
up. Although I grew up in California, it was a little bit more variety than, say, the Midwest at that time. But, just try something new every week, and you never know.
Yeah, go to the produce section and just pick out something you haven't used before.
Exactly.
Learn how to use it.
Or grains, you know, there's all these grains now that we had never heard of 20 years ago, and you may not like all of them, but you may find some new favorites, and variety is nutritionally a good thing, and it's also the spice of life, as they say. So
that's right. How about, I was surprised to read a little section in the beginning of the book about textured vegetable protein.
Mm-hmm.
And because you kind of dispelled some of the myths about it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think you know, I've been around for a long time. There's been a lot of study on soy, and it really was one of the only meat substitutes we had back in the old days.
That's right.
But I think that there's been some misconceptions that people equate it with hydrolyzed vegetable protein,
mm-hmm.
which is not the same thing. And that is something that's used in small amounts in processed foods, but it's not the same thing as textured vegetable protein, which is basically just soy flour that's cooked and then extruded through certain size dyes to make different shapes or granules or whatever, and then dried.
Yeah, so I wonder how that got started, because I had heard it and really haven't used much since I heard that, although I didn't research it, but it's good to know that that's really all it is, just soy flour textured vegetable protein, because it's a great product that you can make into just about anything.
Yeah, it's a good thing to have in your cupboard for emergencies, too, because all you have to do is add hot liquid to it, and you can make a hamburger substitute, or you can have the chunks or whatever. I don't know exactly how that got started, but I should add also that in the book I give resources for finding organic variety of textured vegetable protein, so anybody who's worried about that, too, it is available.
Yeah, well, that is important for soy foods, because there are those nasty genetically modified soybeans running
mm-hmm.
around taking over the world.
Yeah, so it's getting easier, and with the internet, of course, you can get a lot of stuff online, and textured vegetable protein or soy protein is the same thing. Will keep for a long time if you keep it dry, and if you can get a bunch of it online and just stash it in your cupboard for when you can. I like the chunks personally for stews and stir fries. They're
mm-hmm.
really nice. And really, even when you're paying a little bit more for the organic, it's still less expensive than buying the little packages of the meatless strips that they have now, which are good, but they do tend to be a little bit expensive. So,
I don't have much patience for that excuse that it's too expensive, because, in my opinion, what we put in our bodies should be top priority.
Well, that's true, but then there are some people that are on strict budgets, and they do have
yeah.
to think about that. So.
Especially now with the economy, yeah.
Yeah, so I like to, think about that as well. But you can eat really well on a pretty low budget. It's just, I think, a matter of training. Some people just have not learned to cook. Learning to cook is the number one thing for saving money, actually.
Yep, find your kitchen.
Yeah, exactly. Not just for health, but for your budget, too. And it's fun. It can be fun. It doesn't have to be a chore.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that you don't have to eat soy on a vegan diet.
No, exactly. You don't have to. And I try to incorporate soy-free options. And ever since my Known as Italian Kitchen, I've tried to do that in my cookbooks. I don't have any allergies myself, but I try to imagine being a vegan and not eating soy. And, you can come up with lots of things, actually. It's not necessary. But it's not, I don't believe that soy is a bad thing either. I eat it
right.
daily.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I like
yeah.
it. Now, this book, World Vegan Feast, is 200 fabulous recipes from over 50 countries. And I'm just curious, you live on a little island in British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been? Do you travel a lot?
Not really.
That's what I had a feeling.
I live on a budget as well, and when I do travel, it's usually to the States to visit family or friends. But I do have an international background. My father was Peruvian and part Italian, and I'm just interested in everything all over the world. So I read constantly and about different cuisines and try to be as authentic as I can, talk to people. I was lucky to have grown up in San Francisco and then later lived in Vancouver for many years, and those are really cosmopolitan cities with many, many, lots of cultural diversity.
I certainly love to travel, but the world is really at our fingertips now. with the internet, and I live in New York City in Queens, and there are, I think, more languages spoken here than anywhere.
Yeah, maybe Toronto. That's pretty good.
But there are definitely neighborhoods that I go to here where I feel like I'm traveling internationally.
Exactly, yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's wonderful. The high school that I went to in San Francisco had every race and culture and religion that you could think of in it. It was just a real melting pot, and I think that was a really good experience.
Now, you started cooking before you were a vegan. So you have some culinary training from the conventional world.
Yeah, well, self-taught, actually. But, yeah, my mom says that I was cooking before I can remember. She says I used to pull up the stool and, you know, try to help her. And I think I cooked my first dinner, she said, at 6 or something like that. I can't remember.
Well, I think some people come to cooking just naturally, and other people really struggle with it. And that's why detailed cookbooks like this are good for those who are uncomfortable in the kitchen.
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we all shouldn't be, and we need to put it back in our DNA.
Oh, that's for sure. I mean, you know, if you didn't know how to cook before, you'd starve, you know, like servants. So, but it's, and I think it's really important for boys to learn to cook. And, you know, my son is a good cook. My stepsons are good cooks, you know, and there's no reason why, you know, they can't.
Now, do they cook like you? Do you have vegetarians in the family?
Some, not my son, but although he likes what I cook him. One of my daughters, my children are all grown up, of course, and have their own families, but my middle daughter is a vegan now, and two of her daughters are vegetarian, and my oldest granddaughter, who's 19, she became a vegetarian when she was 14.
Yeah, it's funny how it works for some, but it doesn't work for everyone.
Yeah, well, I don't believe in proselytizing to my family. I just, they know what I believe in, and I serve good food. And my husband wasn't a vegan when we got married, and I didn't ask him to be one, but he liked my food. And about 10 years after, he said, well, I guess I'm a vegetarian.
I've heard that before, waking up and, I guess I'm a vegetarian. Well, why not when you've got all this great food around you?
That's right. I mean, that's all that counts with him, if it tastes good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he felt better, and so now he was eating a local egg now and then, but he hasn't even done that for quite a long time. So,
did you come to this for ethical reasons?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I actually was one of the, you know, homesteading, young people in the 1970s, and we had my first late husband and I had homestead and raised our own animals in a, you know, small way. And when we moved to the island, we had a smaller place, and I didn't want to deal with that anymore. And then my husband died, I had been sort of, I wasn't really very interested in food for the first time in my life for a little while, you know.
Sure.
And then I just, you know, I'd always sort of been interested in soy foods. I already knew how to make my own tofu and a sort of old-fashioned way of making seitan that I learned from a Seventh-day Adventist friend, and that always really interested me, so I think I was kind of on my way. And then I realized, you know, we had not bought meat at the store. We had only had our own produce and our own meat and eggs, and that was kind of something that we had decided to do. And I realized, you know, I was buying it from the store again, and I hadn't done that for years, and I decided, well, I don't want to buy it from the store. I don't want to ask somebody else to, you know, butcher this meat.
Do the dirty work.
And so I decided that the only thing to do was become a vegetarian. And then a few months later, I became a vegan because it just seemed to be the logical thing. And then John Robbins' book came out, Diet for a New America.
Yep.
I just read that all in one night, and that just solidified my decision. And that's when I started writing cookbooks, because there weren't very many good ones.
Because we needed them, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating the way the cuisine has developed over the last 30 years.
I mean, just this last year, how many books have come out? How many vegan cookbooks have come out?
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you felt about that.
Oh, I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, there's so many.
I mean, I'm in my 60s now, and I just, I'm so happy that there's this whole new generation of cookbook writers out there, because, you know, I'll probably want to retire at some point. And I might have a book or two left, but there's just so much out there. No, I think it's wonderful, and whenever I go to a conference or something, I think it's really great, all these cookbook authors to get together, and, you know, it's not competitive. We're supporting each other's books, and,
right.
And yeah, just trying to get the word out there, and it's really a great atmosphere, I find.
Well, I really look forward to the day when saying vegan cookbook is sort of redundant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, a lot, most people have a whole bunch of non-vegan cookbooks, so why not a whole bunch of vegan cookbooks, you know?
Absolutely. Well, we know that they're the most popular books that are sold, cookbooks, and so, you know, we definitely need to make a bigger chunk of that.
Oh, yeah, and it's happening. It's definitely happening. And one thing I just want to put out there for people when they're discussing it with other people who might be a little bit, you know, not convinced. I have a good friend here on the island, Fireweed, and she's an animal rights activist, and she always points out that vegan food is not exclusive. It's inclusive because everybody can eat it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's for everyone, and it's good. It's better than good. I think there's more variety when you're cooking vegan.
I think so. I know people, I'm just always still amazed that people will say, oh, but what do you eat? You know, you'd think that they had gotten over that by now, but...
I know.
But, you know...
there are more people doing it, and yet the questions remain the same.
Exactly. Exactly. The whole protein question and blah, blah, blah. But, no, I mean, honestly, I've said this before, but there's no way in my lifetime that I could possibly try not only all the recipes there are out there now, but just all the different combinations that I could think of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just not enough time, and that's pretty amazing, you know. And
I want to talk about chickpea flour for a minute.
Oh, okay.
I noticed you use it in some of your crepes and in your seitan, and I'm like nuts over chickpea flour.
You're not nuts over it?
I love it.
Oh, you love it.
Love it. It's crazy the properties that it has, what it's able to do.
I know. It's a wonderful thing, and I started using it because I used to use soy flour quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
and now some people have problems with that, so I was looking for a substitute, and I started using chickpea flour, and it works really well, but I also love it, the taste of it. I don't know if you've ever tried the farinata recipe and known as the Italian kitchen.
I don't remember, but I will have to go back to it.
It's a chickpea pancake. It's an Italian peasant dish.
Oh.
It's all the rage in a lot of restaurants now, and it's just a flat kind of it's chickpea flour and water that you soak, and it's got a little salt and garlic, and you can put herbs in it, and they eat it as an appetizer. But it has so much flavor.
And yeah, it's crazy.
Hasn't got anything in it, you know?
Well, I kind of discovered chickpea flour. I'm not gluten. I don't have a... what do I want to say? I don't have celiac disease. I think I have some issues with wheat where it gives me a headache, but I'm not convinced. But I just started going... limiting my wheat and discovering all the other flours, just because it just opens the door to so many different flavors and textures and things.
Yeah.
And I just got nuts with the chickpea flour. It's just amazing. Soca and putting it in a it's just great, and it's good for you.
Yes, so farinata is sort of the Italian version of soca.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Italians would tell you that soca is the French version of farinata.
Everybody steals.
It's from the same area, though, in the Mediterranean area, you know. so you know what I'm talking about. I know it's a wonderful thing, and in Indian, it's easy to get in Indian groceries. It's called besan, B-E-S-A-N.
Right.
They use it in a lot of their pancakes and things like that too. So, yeah, I always have a big bag of it in the house.
Well, I love the Indian groceries, too, because you find lots of different beans and flour that you don't see anywhere else.
Oh, yeah. I know. We're lucky, actually, in our area, there's a large East Asian population, and it's really easy to get, even in the smallish town that we shop in supermarkets, you can get, you know, black lentils and, you know, all these kinds of dal that you wouldn't expect to find.
Now, you say you live on an island, but there is access to different kinds of food there. But
On the island, although we do have some farmers that grow vegetables in the summer. But we're just a 10-minute ferry ride from Vancouver Island, and then it's a 15-minute ride up to the nearest town, which is about 30,000.
Sounds pretty nice.
Yeah, it is. It's quite beautiful. It's really worth some of the inconvenience living here. You just learn how to do big shopping.
But for people that don't have access to lots of different foods, this is where the internet comes in.
Exactly, and that's why I tried to put as many resources in the back of the book as I could, and also make that for Canadians and internationals as well as Americans. It was, of course, more available in the United States. But, I don't get a lot of stuff online, but there's some things that I have to buy online, and I'm really grateful for that.
The thing is, you can get dried beans anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're probably one of the best foods that you can. They're inexpensive, and you can do so many different things with them. And there might be people that have allergies to some of the beans. I know fava can be a problem, but for the most part, beans are pretty safe.
Yes, they are, and they're, again, something that will last for quite a long time if you store them properly. I always feel safe, you know, if we have beans and rice in the house, which we always do. You know, you could live on beans and rice. You could try a new recipe from every country every day for beans and rice, or beans and another grain if you want to change it. And I thought of writing a book on that, actually.
Well, one of the things that I like is you really can tell in this book that you know what you're talking about, that you've been there and you've done it many, many, many times. I mean, you can read that in here, which is helpful. And I also like the tone, especially when you talk about preparing beans and you talk about the way different people do it. But the bottom line is, you know, just do it the way you want.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted people to know that, you know, some of the rules that we hear about aren't really true. And so why should that limit us, you know? Whatever way is convenient for you or you think it works out better for you, then, you know, there's really not a wrong way. There's just different ways.
There's also a great discussion in here about egg substitutes, and I think it's probably the best that I've seen in terms of egg substitute discussions. You really break down what we use eggs for, the different properties, and then how substitutes can fill a particular need.
Yeah, I think that's important because I had quite a few failures in my early days, as we all have, I'm sure.
Yeah, failures are fine, and sometimes it leads you to something new.
Exactly. It's a learning experience. So when I thought about it, I thought, okay, well, eggs do so many different things, so one egg substitute probably isn't going to do the trick all the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, you know, it might be useful for other people who are, because I want also this to inspire people to do their own recipes. So the more knowledge you have, the better you'll be at that.
I like using ground flax seeds a lot in water, number one, because flax seeds are so good for us, and because you get that gooey consistency. But I never strained them, and I read in your list of egg substitutes that you can kind of strain the seeds out.
You can. I don't usually do that. And when I want a really light color, I just use the golden flaxseed.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't make things brown. But I think, you know, if you're straining it, you're probably getting some of the fiber out of there, and I like to leave as much fiber as I can in there.
Yeah, I'm kind of a believer that the food should be good for you, nutritious, and taste good, and look good. And for a long time, a lot of cuisine didn't consider the health. And so a lot of chefs will peel things and strain things and leave off all the stuff that's good.
Exactly, yeah, like the tomatoes, taking the... I think I mentioned that somewhere about not taking the seeds out of tomatoes. They found actually now that the seeds and the gel around the seeds contains a lot of the flavor of tomatoes.
Right.
So why should we get rid of them? I've always, maybe it's laziness, but I never did that.
I know, me either, and they're good for you, and we really need to change that negative attitude about leaving the healthy parts of food in the recipes.
Mm, exactly.
Anyway, it's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope you have a wonderful holiday.
Yes, you too. Well, I know I'm going to be digging into this book and making some really fun things, so thank you.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay, you too. That was Brianna Clark-Grogan, and check out her website. Very informative. Lots of great things at BriannaClarkGrogan.com. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.